You're back with Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. Photographer Edward Curtis spent decades working on his magnum opus, a 20-volume set of images and anthropological research called The North American Indian. His goal was to photograph members of every existing Native American tribe at a time when many Indians were living in squalor on reservations, sometimes far from their original lands. Curtis was praised for his painterly images, which showed Native Americans as real-life human beings. But he paid a high price for his endeavor. His marriage fell apart. He suffered bouts of depression. And when he died in 1952, obituaries barely mentioned his master work, which now can sell for upwards of $1 million at auction. New York Times columnist Timothy Egan has written a biography of Curtis. It's called Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher. Timothy Egan, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back with you.
In the 1890s, Edward Curtis was a portrait photographer in Seattle. This is at a time when sitting for a photograph was still quite rarefied. And in 1896, he photographs a Native American woman who was living in a shack near the water. She was known as Princess Angeline. Why did Curtis find her so compelling?
Well, first of all, she's the last Indian living in a city, Seattle, that is the biggest city in the world named for an Indian. They've essentially passed a law making it illegal for Native Americans to live within the city limits, except for her, because she's sort of this quaint, stooped, little, tiny, elfin, lost figure. The little kids throw rocks at her, and she lives in the shack, and they take tourists down to see her. And it's sort of a validation of the idea at the dawn of the 20th century, which is that Indians are disappearing. They will soon be past tense, and so here's one in their midst. And in fact, the census has come out and said there are only 235,000 Native Americans living in all of the United States, down from anywhere from 20 to 40 million at the time of European contact. So first of all, it's a sense to Curtis that, you know, she's sort of a commodity. She will soon disappear, and it'll be worth something to take a picture of these people that will soon disappear. The second thing is he has sort of an epiphany. He's this studly guy. He's an artist. He's already famous in the region. He takes the pictures of the debutantes and the bankers and the merchants who all want to sit for their portrait from the young, good-looking Edward Curtis. But he has a sort of artistic moment as well. He sees a flash of authenticity, this Native American against the water, and he sees that part of this region is being completely erased. Now, he doesn't hatch what will become the magnificent obsession of his art, of his great work, but he has that moment.
I love your description of this photograph, which is in the book and which we'll post to our website, cpr.org, this photo of Princess Angeline. And you write, the lines in her face are so deep, so prominent, they look like scars from a knife fight, as if someone had carved her visage from a pumpkin. Her mouth is downturned. To look at the face and not see humanity is to lack humanity. One thing you do in this book is you'll often tell the story that builds up the photograph, and then the book reveals the photograph.
I'm so glad you deciphered my design, because you are the first person to figure that out or to say it publicly. That's exactly what I was trying to do here. I wanted to build up in each of those chapters, and then you see the payoff. You see the photographic payoff. Now, I'll make one more point about Princess Angeline, is that people often accuse Edward S. Curtis of romanticizing his portraits of American Indians, and in some there is. But in the aggregate, there certainly is not. And in that picture, there is not. That is a very hard glare that stares at you through the ages. That is a look that says the worlds have been lost, people have all died, land's been taken. And you see that same, some of that same expression in Geronimo, the last of the Indians to fight the Americans who gave up finally in the 1880s. And this incredible picture that Curtis took of him looking away, a lot like Angeline, wrapped only in an army blanket. You see that same look in Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce. It is not a romantic image in any sense of it.
We'll post the photographs you just mentioned as well to cpr.org. You talk about him being riveted by Princess Angeline, but it wasn't really what started his project to document every remaining tribe. It's really some people he meets, I guess, on a hike.
He's up on Mount Rainier and he's leading a climb up there, and he bumps into, in the fog on the glacier, two of the most famous people in America. One is the founder of the National Geographic Society. The other's founder of the Audubon Society. And they're very prominent, famous. Bird Grinnell and Hart Merriam are their names. They're prominent, important men from the East. This is one of many encounters Curtis will have in his life with important people. You know, within 10 years of Curtis living in this homestead shack, he's dining with Teddy Roosevelt, the president, at the summer White House and taking pictures of his daughter's wedding. These people he meets, by the way, lead him to see larger Indian communities. Bird Grinnell says, come with me to Montana. You'll get to know real Indians. They're not just poor little helpless figures living on the shore in a shack. They're entire living communities, young people, old people, living as they've always lived, gathering as they've always gathered every summer, in this case in Montana, in the high plains, to have the Sundance. And that's what starts Curtis at the dawn of the 20th century in 1900 on what will become the largest photographic odyssey in American history.
You're listening to Colorado Matters on Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner, and the New York Times columnist Timothy Egan is with us to talk about his book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher. Shadow Catcher was a nickname given to the photographer Edward Curtis, who had this incredible 30-year journey documenting Indian tribes across the United States and Canada. You write that tribal distrust of Curtis was widespread, and I want to know how he convinced tribes to allow him to take photographs.
It was widespread initially. Early on, they throw dirt at his camera. And I want to stress, this is a 14 by 17 inch view camera where each picture involves a glass plate negative that, you know, is the size of a piece of a computer paper or bigger. So he took a long time to set up each one of these pictures. But they throw dirt at his camera. They report him to the Indian agents. They don't trust him. But over the years, very soon, within a couple of years, because Curtis has a native staff, he always hires translators, they start to understand what he's doing. They get that he's genuinely interested in their culture. And as time goes on, they're writing to him and saying, will you come to our tribe next? Because they're seeing these pictures and they're seeing that no one has captured these faces of these native people, as has Edward Curtis. You know, they're stereotyped. People consider them either, you know, cigar, dime store Indians or noble savages. In Curtis, you see human beings.
You know, you think about someone who is going to dedicate his life to photographing tribes all over the country, who has to lug expensive equipment. And this means that Curtis spends a lot of time looking for a benefactor. I mean, this is expensive stuff, right? And he eventually convinces J.P. Morgan, the wealthy industrialist, to fund his project. What is their financial arrangement?
Morgan is a collector of art and mistresses and beautiful things. He's 70 years old. And he has no reason to like Indians, believe me. His railroads, which he helped to consolidate, were probably the things that doomed the Plains tribes in Colorado, in Montana, in the Dakotas, because once these tribes saw the iron horses coming, they knew they were cooked because they were shooting the buffalo. So he goes in to see Morgan, and he makes this essentially pact with the devil. Morgan approves of the project reluctantly initially, and agrees to give him money, but he won't pay for Curtis's salary. Curtis will work for free. And ultimately, Morgan ends up paying in dollars in those period, $2.5 million. And I don't want to spoil the story here for your readers and listeners, but Curtis ends up losing his copyright to Morgan. That's the pact with the devil. So over the course of this 30 years, he does fund the Great Odyssey, but Curtis loses everything.
I was surprised to learn that in addition to all of his photographs, Curtis also recorded more than 10,000 American Indian songs on primitive wax cylinders. And we tracked one down. This is from 1910, recorded in British Columbia. He really saw himself, Timothy Egan, as much more than a photographer. You call him an amateur anthropologist.
he saw himself as a documentarian of cultures. So he did record more than 10,000 songs. He did record countless languages, as he told an interviewer in his old age, in his dying years, when he was all but forgotten, he was trying to explain what he had done. He said, in many cases, especially on the West Coast, we recorded the last man to speak the language. And now, in our modern age, as tribes have resurrected the languages, as some of them have had some prosperity with casinos and other things, they have these priceless artifacts of Curtis recording the last human being to speak the language. I mean, there's just, it's one thing to look at songs in sheet music, which Curtis also wrote down, or it's one thing to read a language, which he also wrote down. But there's no substitute for hearing how the words are pronounced or how the songs are sung.
Edward Curtis not only loses out financially, or I guess professionally, he loses out personally as well. He pays a really high price for his work.
Curtis knew he had pulled off a masterpiece because it was called that. He did 227 sets of these 20 volumes. They were compared to the King James Bible and John James Audubon's Birds of America. So he knew he'd created a masterpiece, but he finishes it at the dawn of the Great Depression. So he's broke, and his family life has completely fallen apart. He goes through this terribly bitter divorce where he even loses his beloved studio in Seattle and the rights to the glass plate negatives, which is what he shot his pictures on. So at one point he goes to his studio after the court has awarded all his stuff to his really embittered wife, and he smashes the glass plate negatives. He's worried she's going to exploit them. So he's penniless, having completed this masterpiece. He moves to Los Angeles and takes up residence in this little one-room apartment in Beverly Hills, and he shoots for the movie companies, including, you know, fake Indian movies, things like this movie The Plainsman, starring Gary Cooper, and all the Indians are Italians in face paint. Here's the guy who's done more to document real Indian faces, and he ends up shooting, you know, these stills for movies. He spends the last 20 years of his life living just a pauper's existence and having lost every single copy of his masterpiece except for one, which he didn't tell his creditors about. And during this period, he suffers two complete mental breakdowns. One is when he's in Denver. He goes to a sanitarium. He goes completely dark. I guess the modern interpretation would be he suffered from manic depression. But he goes to the sanitarium where he's a ward of the state, essentially. He's a charity case. So not only does he lose financially, losing, you know, the whole copyright to this thing and never seeing a dime for this, but he loses his physical and mental health as well with these two breakdowns.
And today, the collection goes for, I think, in one auction, $1.8 million.
Yes, that's for a single set. And individual pictures go for up to $250,000. So yes, financially, the market has valued him more than ever. But I'd like to talk about a larger legacy, which is the Native people themselves. Curtis at the time thought they were dying, which everyone else did. Well, the census of 2010 counted 2.8 million Native people who are mostly full blood living within the borders of the United States. A terrific rebound, tenfold. Curtis would be very happy with that. More importantly, the Indian people themselves appreciate him. I went to almost every reservation, every tribal homeland in the United States that Curtis went to, and I always saw Curtis pictures. You go to the Hopi homeland in Arizona, you go to the Blackfeet Nation in Montana, you see Curtis pictures. They point to these pictures and they say, there's my great-grandfather. There's the face of our people. I understand why they wear their hair that way. I understand why they wear their beads that way. There's the song that we had almost forgotten. That's in some ways a more important legacy than the fact that the financial and artistic market has caught up with the degree of the masterpiece.
Timothy, thank you so much for being with us.
Ryan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for your interest in the subject.
Timothy Egan is the author of Short Nights of the Shadowcatcher, the epic life and immortal photographs of Edward Curtis. And again, some of those photographs are at our website, cpr.org.